Session number 9722.
So we're in room 3.
Now, the Lassam seemed very apprehensive during the night, and he was shivering, I don't know, with cold or fright, I don't know. But I had an incident with De La Salle in Madriguera, so this was revealing to me. I was on guard at the commandant's house, and at about 3 in the morning, a dispatch rider came, and a Frenchman, and he had a message for De La Salle. And I went to De La Salle's bedroom and knocked at the door. And it was quite a time before he answered the door. And when he did answer the door, he just opened it ajar. I can see he was in his long johns, and a revolver was pointing at me through the door. And I said to him, my limited French, I said, a dispatch rider, message, I forgot the word I used, for message or something like that. And he seemed quite relieved and withdrew his revolver, and the dispatch rider stepped forward and gave the message. Now, I thought later on, I thought that was very funny. We were now in Madrigueras, which was about 200 kilometres from Madrid, from the front. And yet he came to the door with a revolver in his hand. I had that experience with De La Salle. And then later on, the following night, he sent me to prison. And
why did he send you to prison?
Well, I was on guard at his house with Bill Benson. And it was very cold. This was late December. It was very cold in La Mancha. It's a big plain, that part of Spain. It's bitterly cold. And about midnight, some officer says, look, don't stand outside in the cold, you know, there's no need to. Stand inside the house next to the door. It's just as good, you know. And we could smell the supper being cooked for the Colonel de La Salle and his guests, who were other French officers from surrounding villages where other international brigade men were being trained. There was a whole number at that time had already come to Spain, several thousand. And there was an organisation in being. And Bill Benson says to me, he says, hey, Mo, he says, call me Mo, my name is Morris. And he says, the food we were getting was garbanzos and mule meat stew every day. We were fed up with it. And they were cooking liver and onions, you know, and it smelled beautifully. So he says, hey, go along to the kitchen and see if they've got anything to spare. I thought that sounded reasonable enough. So I said, look, there's no need for me carrying my rifle. I mean, I suppose I was a bit of a good soldier strike, really. And I thought there's no need to carry my rifle, took my rifle back into the kitchen there. And I left it near him. And I went to the kitchen and spoke to the French. And they told me in very short terms where to get. If there's anything over, it was for them, not for the two Englishmen. And I returned to my post. In the meantime, a man called Vidal, who was a commissar, who was, I believe, a city councillor in Paris, had entered the building to go to this supper, and he asked Bill, what's that rifle doing there? He said, it's my comrade, he's gone to the kitchen. So I didn't think very much about it. But a little later on, I was sent for, after they'd eaten the supper, these people, and I was sent for to go into this dining room. There was about 7 or 8 officers, I mean, all dressed in officers' uniform. And De La Salle got up and harangued me in French, which I couldn't understand. But I knew the final word, he says, prison. See? And they sent for somebody, and I was thrown into the local... It was a Guardia Civil quarters, you know, not a big place, small place. And I was taken upstairs and thrown into this room, dark, no light, and just lay on the floor, brick floor. And in the morning, I looked around with me, and there was 4 other men there, Frenchmen. And these were really tough characters. I didn't know how long I'd been sent to prison for. Just sent to prison. And they had been thrown into prison because they'd been drunk every day. And they told me all the four of them were pals, and they were deserters from the French Foreign Legion, which I can readily believe. They were really tough characters.
In what way?
Pardon?
In what way?
Well, by their demeanour, and also while they were in prison, they had pals outside, and they would lower a bottle or some receptacle on a piece of string, and the pals would fill it up with wine, and they'd hold it up, and they were still bloody drunk all day during the prison. And they were really characters, these four men. Now, we built a little fire. I made a pillow out of two bricks as a pillow, but we had nothing. And we made a bit of a fire, and we got some bread, and I started toasting the bread as best as I could on this wood fire. And they thought that was a good idea, and they followed me, and, you know, and it was really hilarious, you know, at times in that prison with these four other Frenchmen. And eventually, after about a week, I was released along with the Frenchmen, because now we were going to the front. And I left from the prison to entrain to go to La Pera, to Andalusia.
Let's pick up the story in Andalusia. You said you've gone back to the British unit and you were describing the events there. What happened after you'd guarded La Salle?
We go back to our unit in the same spot which we had left the day before, or the night before. And the following night, we'd sort of missed the previous night's sleep, more or less, and both Quinn and I slept heavily. Now, we dug away about a foot behind the bole of the olive tree for protection, you know, against fire, rifle fire. And with dawn, we wakened about six, but it was very quiet. And we both thought it was very quiet. And we couldn't understand why there was no movement. And Quinn says, you go and have a look where Nathan had his little command post, a little way from us. And I went there, and the place was empty, and there was two dead men lying there, and a bit of equipment lying around, a blanket or two. And I went to another, everybody seems to gather around an olive tree, you know, there was only about 6 yards apart, or even less than that, where you got a bit of shelter and so on. And I saw there was nobody there, and I got a great shock. I was really afraid for the first time, but I hadn't been afraid in action previously. But I found difficulty in walking, because I realised everybody had gone, and we were left behind, Quinn and I, and we knew the enemy was in front. And there's all sorts of stories that there were Moors, you know, and they mutilated you. Don't know if it's just propaganda or what, but you sort of believed it. And they took away your manhood, etc., etc. All these horror stories. And I stumbled back to Quinn. Now, Quinn had been in the British Army. And I says, do you think it's been an advance? Advance, he says, be buggered, he says. He said, it's a treat. He says, it would have been an advance to be people coming up behind us, you know. He said, come on, let's get away. So we packed up our gear, we had a blanket each and our rifle, and we had one orange. And we started walking away. I said, let's walk this way, because I knew I'd been a bit of a rambler beforehand on the Kinder Scout moors between Manchester and Sheffield. I knew my way about sort of country without paths and so on. And I knew we had to walk away from the sun, because the sun set in the enemy's lines. And we walked all day, keeping away from Hyatt's, and we shared the one orange and the peeled two. At dusk on that day, about 6 o'clock in the afternoon, we were walking we didn't walk on the road, we walked in plantations, fields, or where there were trees and so on, sort of keeping out of observation. And we wouldn't go to any farm building we saw because we didn't know what territory we were in.
Were you carrying weapons?
We were carrying rifles. And then we saw four soldiers on the road at a crossroads standing there. And we could see the village a bit further ahead. And I said to him, let's wait here. And when it gets really dark, we'll go into the village and listen to the voices. You see, we were the foreign speak, you know, French and Italian. We knew that we were a Republican. He was fed up. I was a bit fed up, but I still didn't want to give up easily. And he said, come on, he said, let's get it over with. Well, I didn't fancy, you know, there was talks there, getting shot on the spot and all that business. And we went over there and they were dark-skinned. And we thought, no, it'd be Moors, these blokes. But they were Spanish Republican soldiers. And we had very little Spanish. And I remember saying to them, usted is Pola Caballero. Now, Caballero was the Prime Minister. They thought, these fellows are off his bloody head. Are you gentlemen? Caballero means a gentleman. So they can see we were weary and we were foreigners. So sit down. And we sat down on the floor, on the ground. And then a dispatch rider came along, a Frenchman, and they stopped him. And he took one of us on the pillion to the village, then came back and brought the other one. I forgot who went first. And we had actually walked all day from 6 in the morning till 6 in the evening with hardly a stop, because we knew we had to get away from the area. And we had actually gone to the village where Nathan and his men were. It was remarkable.
Do you know the name of the village?
No. But what had happened, they left this front at La Pera because the attack by the Franco forces had been halted at that village, and now they moved to another part on the top of a hill where I could see the snow-capped mountain of the Sierra Nevada. And we stayed there. There was no action there. We stayed there several days. And from there, we returned to Andújar and then travelled north to Madrid to the next front at Las Rosas de Madrid.
Can you describe what happened there at Las Rosas?
At Las Rosas. This was also... It gives you an idea. I don't want to be heroic or anything like that. But as we were moving up to the front, the action already started, I believe, a few days earlier by other international brigade men and no doubt Spanish Republican soldiers there. And we passed some people who were not at the front soldiers, who were the remnants of the Tailman Column. And they called out to us. Now, the Tailman Column had been disseminated, you know, in the action or something like that, suffered great losses because we passed them on the road. And it meant nothing to us. You know, we were already hardened soldiers because we'd been down in La Pera. And I thought, oh, well, it's all right. They couldn't do anything to the enemy. We'll do it. And we had a man in command under Nathan named Kit Conway, an IRA man. Now, lots of these IRA people, they'd had some kind of military training of their own in their own country, you see. And nearly all of them felt they were all military experts. There's no question about that. And I remember going into action. It was misty that evening. And the story is told at that time in Hugh Thomas's book that a whole company of Frenchmen in the mist walked into the enemy lines and were never seen again. I don't know. But it was misty. We were now in the foothills of the Guadarramas, Chaiwe, the 10th. That was first night. And we're each given four hand grenades each, besides our rifle ammunition, you see, because we knew we were in close proximity to the enemy anyway. You couldn't see, it was like foggy, mist swirling around. And we bedded down for the night like that. Two grenades in this pocket here, the other.
In your breast pocket?
Breast pockets, and two in your pocket, and we laid down. And we had guards out, you see. And that was our first night. It was raining, we were bloody miserable, and so on. And then the next morning, we can see the village of Las Rosas de Madrid. I can only speak for our British unit. And Nathan was in command, and we lay, and the enemy were in the village, and they were firing from the church tower, and we were spread out along the ridge of some kind of a bit of a hill, and Nathan was walking about, standing up, and we were losing casualties by the machine gun fire from the tower, the church tower. And we wouldn't, I mean, Nathan was walking about leading a charmed existence. People were getting killed, you know. Then I told you that shell dropped in right near us. And suddenly, our artillery hit the church tower. And we all cheered. And that got rid of the bloody machine gun, whoever was there. Now, I've been back to that very spot. I went back in 1978. And now, we're in this little village, along with a Spanish friend of mine, whom I'd met in Manchester. He was a research graduate at the university here. And we're talking to four or five peasants, men who were from the Civil War period, men of about late 60s, 70. And the Franco regime was, Franco was dead, but the Franco regime was still in power. And they were very reluctant to discuss things with us, because I was there with my friend and this Spanish man from Madrid, and we were talking about the war and so on. They were very cagey, very reluctant to talk. And then I told them about the tower. You can see where the tower's been rebuilt. And there was a man, a younger man amongst these people. He says, I was here at the time. He was a barber in that village, and that broke the ice, you see. So I've been back to that actual spot, along with the other battlefronts I was at. After some time on that front, the fighting died down, and now more and more Britishers have arrived, and we're training now in Madrigueras. There was about 400 or 500 who were forming the British battalion. And because of language difficulties, we left the French and returned to Madrigueras under the command of George Nathan. Now, when Nathan got back, by that time, and I must tell you this because I'm a big believer in the truth. I think it's best to tell the truth and not to hide what might be unpleasant things to other people. Now, when we got back, by this time, there were people sent out by the Communist Party who'd had experience in the First World War, like Tom Wintringham, who'd been a captain in the First World War, Oxbridge graduate or somebody. There was another man named Wilfred McCartney, who had seen service in the First World War, or was somehow connected with the Communist Party. That man had an interesting past. He had been sent to prison for carrying out espionage or something like that. He wrote a book called Walls of Mouths. And by this time, the Communist Party, that is like people sent from England, were now getting a grip on the organisation and would not naturally tolerate people being elected by the men as their leaders. It was now, an army was being organised and formed. And they didn't want Nathan, because Nathan was nobody to them, despite. But the French already knew of the character of Nathan and his qualities. And Nathan commanded one of the French battalions later on and left the British. And two British volunteers whom I knew, one came from the Isle of Wight. He was a young architect, and the other fellow, London, he was the King's Road before the King's Road was ever heard of. He was a bohemian type, wore a Van Dyke beard, an Australian first, military
slouch hat.
He had a paisley scarf, and he had a ginger Van Dyke beard. Oh, Michael Livesey was the boy from what do you call it, and they fought with the French at Segovia. That's the other side of the Guadalajara Mountains, which, by the way, was the scene of the story which Hemingway wrote called Where the Bell Tones. And Nathan became the commander of a French battalion. They were more logical than the British. It was a pity Nathan was not retained, because he was a military man and knew what it was all about. And the other people, I mean, with all due respect to Copeman, who came on later on, I mean, Copeman was a sailor, an ordinary seaman or something like that. What does he know about military tactics and et cetera, et cetera? He was a good bloke, but he couldn't compare to Nathan as regards military knowledge. And Nathan finally became, I didn't see Nathan again, but he became chief of staff of the 15th Brigade on the Brunetti Offensive, where he lost his life at the end of the battle.
So did you feel at the time that this was some kind of Communist Party organisational takeover?
Well, not necessarily in not in its sort of hidden terms, you know, like something. You one accepted it that this was necessary. You see, and I was already elected at that time, after coming back from Las Rosas, when we formed what was called the Brigade Guard Company. This was prior to going to the Jarama, see? Now, most of the people of the survivors of the 45 became section leaders and company commanders in the British battalion that was going to take part in the Battle of Jarama, because they were experienced. Then there was about 20, you see, who were formed as the Brigade Guard Company, and I was elected as the political delegate, you see. Now, when we got to Chinchon, you heard of Chinchon, that's the place that was a staging post before going into battle at Jarama, a man named Springall, D.F. Springall, who was an official of the Communist Party, he came to see us in our billet in Chinchon and wanted to know who had elected. See, I introduced myself, I was the delegate, who had elected me? And I says, the men. So he said, oh, he says, well, he says, that's going to be all altered from now on, but he says, well, let things remain as they are. And now then we went to the front. I was not in the first few days in the Battle of Jarama. I was at Moratati Tajunya, which was the village just behind the battlefront, about 3/4 mile, where the command was, you know, the brigade not very far from that little village. And I was in charge of the Brigade Guard Company. Then, after about 3 days, I had the request to furnish a guard for General Walter, who was going to visit the front. Now, my pal, Eddie Swindles, who went out with me, and I asked for volunteers. We asked for about a dozen volunteers to form an escort, because it's still the battle was going on, you know, and to guard Walter going to the front. And I remained behind, in charge of the remainder. Now then, when I got to the front about a week later, or 10 days later, from Morata di Tajunya, and now I go into number one company, and I was made the commissar for that company, simply because the other people had all lost their lives, I was a number one company man, I'd already been in action, you understand me, in two actions before. So it was either George Aitken, you may have heard of him,
yes,
who told me that I was now the political commissar of number one company. I mean, don't give it the connotations it might have. He was really like the welfare officer of the unit. And I was the commissar of the number one company on the Jarama, which I was on. I was wounded on the Jarama. I went back after 8 or 10 days and remained on the Jarama till we left the Jarama in the middle of June, middle of June. And I went to the front in the Brunetti Offensive, and I was wounded on the first night outside of Villanueva de la Cañada. That was the first village we fought for, in a hand-to-hand fight on the outskirts of the village. And this time I was more severely wounded, and I was taken to the Escorial. You heard of the great palace, the Escorial, which was used as a first post for wounded people, and I remained there for only a few hours. I was only a walking wounded, my arm was
bicep had been shattered, my arm was useless, and I was then moved to a hospital in Madrid, in the center, in Velasquez 62, I can always remember the place, and I was there a while, and then my arm was put in what's called an aeroplane splint. It was a metal contraption, because my muscle had been shattered, you see, the bicep, and my arm was lifeless, and I had to, this was strapped with this metal cage. I believe they used it in the First World War. Well, when eventually the metal cage was removed, my arm was rigid, horizontal to my arm, and wouldn't go down. And when I finally got to Huete Hospital and saw Dr. Tudor Hart, and after I'd been there about a week, my arm had improved, he told me that if it doesn't start going down of its own accord, he would have to operate on me and break my arm, you know, and make it straight. Now, fortunately, about a day or two later, I helped a man named George Green, who was the husband of Nan Green, and he was the domestic driver for the hospital, bringing in supplies and so on. And he was a very nice man. He was helping a carpenter in the village to get bolts of timber for him or something like that. And he saw me in the village, and I was walking around with my arm like this. And he says, "Morris, come and help me to unload this timber." And although my arm was strong in the sense I could hold things in it like that, and I always remember I held one after log piece of timber in this hand like that. And from that day onwards, it went, you know, giving it that weight and exercise from that, because they had no facilities for doing anything with it in the hospital. And from that day onward, gradually it receded lower and lower till it went back to normal. And then I was sent from there to a convalescent centre at Salaces, which was run by the Americans. Their hospital nearby was called Villa Path, and the convalescent place was a former shooting lodge of the royal family, where I stayed, I don't know, maybe 2 weeks. And from there, I went to Tarazona, where I was asked to take charge of the messing arrangements in the camp, which was a training camp.
Let me stop you there, and can we go back to the Madrid front? You were at Las Rosas, first of all.
Yes.
And then after that to Jarama.
That's right. No, Jarama, that's right. That's right.
Can you describe what you experienced at Jarama in detail?
Yes. I can remember one day in particular, that was February the 27th. And I didn't know too much about it on that occasion, except that we were firing at the enemy from morning to afternoon. By this time, you were now, it was like the First World War, with trenches, sandbags, barbed wire, etc., etc. A front that stretched from Arganda Bridge to somewhere past Morata de Tijuña. Now, I did not know, but I've learned since, because I've read fairly extensively on the Civil War. And on our left flank were the Americans.